thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. In addition to our guest interview, we'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom, Chag Sameach and Moadim L'Simcha. We are celebrating the lovely holiday of Sukkot, the last days now, and getting ready for Simchat Torah, the concluding festival of our long Jewish fall holiday marathon, which ends with a wonderful bang tomorrow night, Monday night and Tuesday, or tonight and tomorrow, depending on your affiliation, practice, and location. If you are conservative or Orthodox and not living in the land of Israel, Monday night and Tuesday are the wonderful festival of Simchat Torah, when we complete the reading of the Torah and begin again for the coming year. Simchat Torah literally means rejoicing with Torah or celebrating the teaching, and it's a time of singing, dancing, drinking, eating, and real joy. We will celebrate Monday night. Tomorrow night at 6:30 p.m. at Congregation Beit Simcha, we'll be dedicating our brand new Torah. Join the fun in person or come on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, and it is as much fun as any Jewish holiday ever can be. This year at my own congregation, we have this unique and fabulous event dedicating our Torah, a new Torah for our congregation. Simchat Torah always reminds me when I started as a student back at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. They asked me to lead services, but I was starting as a cantor right after Simchat Torah. I sat through the first few hakafot of Simchat Torah, the parades with the Torah, listening to dull, plodding music. Finally, I turned to the dean of the college, Rabbi Ken Ehrlich at the time, and asked him what was happening. Like me, he is mostly descended from Eastern European Jews who do Simchas Torah, singing, dancing with enthusiasm and energy. It's a near wanton celebration. Ken explained that when he first came to the college, the Torah Hakafot for Simchat Torah were done in a slow, stately procession, accompanied by plodding organ music. He himself had turned to his professor and asked, "It's Simchas Torah, how come they're marching, not dancing?" And the professor answered, "They are German Jews. They are dancing." Anyway, this is one version of what Simchat Torah can sound like. On Simchas Torah, we actually complete the reading of the end of the book of Deuteronomy with the story of the death of Moses, and then immediately open a second Torah and chant the opening passages of Genesis. As Jews, we are always reading Torah, and Simchat Torah celebrates our dedication to learning and growing in our knowledge and our relationship with God. The Jewish holiday cycle for the fall, which began back in September with Slichot, continued through Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, and Shmini Atzeret, and now Simchat Torah is a wonderful way to complete it all with Torah. This year, we are dedicating a new Torah at Beit Simcha. I might have mentioned that. We'll begin to use it on Simchat Torah and chant from the beginning of creation and, you know, everything. Israeli poet and songwriter Ehud Manor wrote a beautiful poem called Breishit, Genesis. In the beginning there was sky, in the beginning the sea was blue, in the beginning I had day and night, hours as many as the sands. In the beginning, the land was a soft grass as a present for her. In the beginning, a garden in Eden, garden with no gate from heaven, good rain falling and God merciful with dawn. He gave you to me to guard and keep, you to me. In the beginning, I had sun. In the beginning, birds sang to me. In the beginning, the fruit was ripe come evening, strawberries and grains, a garden in Eden. For the week of Simchat Torah and the chanting of Bereishit, Genesis, here's Gabi Shoshan's 2011 cover of his own recording from way back in the 1970s. Bereishit hayu shamayim, Bereishit haya hayam kacho, Bereishit hayu li yom valayla, Shaila, Gan be'eden, gan bishar, bishamayim, yeshem tov the song Bereishit, Genesis, for the beginning of Torah. Simchat Torah tomorrow, Monday night, at Congregation Beit Simcha, 6:30 p.m. Join us as we dedicate a brand new Torah for us. Everyone is welcome to come. Our guest this morning is the very youngest guest we've ever had on Too Jewish during the more than 20 years we've been on the air. Her name is Suzette Scheff. She will share just what motivated her to begin writing her extraordinary young adult story about the Holocaust, running for shelter at the tender age of 13. She's just 16 now. Meet her when we come back on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Suzette Schaft is the author of Running for Shelter, a young adult true story Holocaust book. She wrote it when she was 13 years old. She's now all of 16 years old, which makes her, after 20 years of Two Jewish, the youngest guest we have ever had officially on Two Jewish. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, you know, I don't want to give away too much, but you say it right off the bat. When you were 13, your father died after a two-year fight against a terrible disease, pancreatic cancer. And you wanted to capture his spirit, and to some degree you decide that influenced you. Tell us about that experience, if it's not too much.
Of course, yeah. So when I was 13, my dad passed away to pancreatic cancer, and he influenced me because when I was younger, he used to tell me stories about his life while tucking me in each night. But during the months following his death, I could only try to connect the mismatched puzzle pieces of my recollections of his stories. And so I started to fantasize about rewinding time so that I could go back and record these stories. And this made me wish I had taken the time to write them down when I had the chance. So in that sense, my father's death sort of revealed to me the importance of preserving the stories of our loved ones before it is too late.
And that led you to explore your grandmother's story. Tell us about that.
Yes. So that led me to exploring my grandmother's story because I wanted to combine two of my interests, so my passion for recording family stories and my interest and fascination with the Holocaust. And so I turned to my grandmother, who is actually my father's mom, and I asked her if I could interview her story and immortalize it, to preserve it forever, because I didn't want the same thing with her story to happen to what my dad's stories. And so, especially because stories about the Holocaust are so important to preserve.
Why, you know, you're young. Why are the stories about the Holocaust so important to you? Is it just this family connection, or is there something else?
Well, this specific family connection is one of the reasons why I know so much about the Holocaust. I think that if my grandmother hadn't, you know, grown up during World War II, and if I wasn't Jewish, I probably wouldn't know as much as I know now about the Holocaust. And this family connection kind of is one of the reasons it pushed me to read more about the Holocaust and to hear more about survivors' stories. And so I think that without this connection, I wouldn't have been introduced to this topic. But ever since I was introduced to this topic, I just feel like a passion to record their stories, but not only of the Holocaust. I hope to later on also record stories of other genocide survivors as well. So I've just taken an interest in genocides and survivors.
It's by the way, I don't want to minimize the book. The book is charming, and we'll talk more and much more with our guest this morning, Suzette Schaft. She's the author of Running for Shelter, a true story, Holocaust books for young adults. But it's not really just for young adults, and we'll talk more about that when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a wonderful array of services, classes, and events this autumn. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Religious school has begun for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our wonderful Hebrew school on Sundays, our Bar and Bat Mitzvah program, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs in a wonderful, fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come Friday night or Saturday morning or both. You can email me directly, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or join us Friday night on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. each week. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson. Our services are there. And, of course, in person with Oneg Shabbats and Kiddushes. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. Go to the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. And the same for our religious school, in person or in blended format. This coming Monday night, that's tomorrow night, help us dedicate our new Torah, 6:30 p.m. at Simchat Torah Celebration Services, Monday, October 17th. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, live and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of Arizona and its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com, TOOJewishRadio18@gmail, or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, TOOJewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, his very popular Jewish podcast, or from Spotify, or from Podbean. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. Please post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to our podcast. Those comments help. In the midst of this week of Thanksgiving in Judaism, we have had some unpleasant reminders of just how pernicious and virulent racism can be. It came from different places of our society. Rapper, music mogul, and, well, whack job, Kanye West sent out another series of anti-Semitic tweets. And in an ongoing national political scandal, the chair of the Los Angeles City Council was recorded making racist comments about blacks and also, by the way, Jews and Armenians. Who did she miss? She herself is Latino, and she made those comments in an open discussion with two other council members who didn't object. Finally, she resigned, although her colleagues so far have not. It's an ugly reminder that racism of any kind is a deep human evil, and that the oldest surviving form of racism, the one responsible for pogroms and genocide for 2,000 years, is anti-Semitism. My friends, there is no place in our society for racism, and there should be no place anywhere in Judaism for racism either. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, atypically, you have just come back from a trip to northern Italy, but you mean a specific part of northern Italy, which has a fascinating history, an important Italian history, and an important Jewish history, but it wasn't always part of Italy. Tell us about it.
Right. So you make several good points, one of which is northern Italy is very far from east to west. And so, like, the northeast tip of Italy was always part of Austria, really, and the Austrians still refer to it as Sud Tirol, and the Italians call it Alto Adige, and the schools are bilingual, and the villages all have two names. Like, the most famous capital of that region is Bolzano in Italian, but it's Bozen in German. And then you come to the Veneto and a few other regions, and then you come to Milano, and then you come to the big industrial city of Torino, the home of Fiat. Now, Torino was the first capital of modern unified Italy, because the king of Savoy, Vittorio Emanuele, became the first king of Italy, and
right.
Is still like the scion of the royal family of Italy.
And it's why the Italian national team wears blue, which isn't in the Italian national flag, but it was the Savoyan colors.
Right. Good point. And Savoy, at one point, extended into parts of what are now France and Switzerland as well. So, you know, it's a shapeshifter like every European country, as we've mentioned in the past, whether Germany, France, Italy, the shape and the borders have changed over the centuries and sometimes even over the decades, and most recently as a result of World War II. So Torino is the capital of a country that used to be Savoy, but it's now a region of Italy, which is called Piemonte, which means the foot of the mountain, because it's like on the southern slopes of the Swiss Alps. If you go due north from the region I visited, you hit Mont Blanc and the famous Mont Blanc tunnel. We did not spend any time in Torino. I landed at the Torino airport and was met by two very old friends. We then drove like 2 hours, 2.5 hours southwest to a sub-region called the Langhe. And the Langhe is famous because of wine-producing villages like Barolo, Barbaresco, Barbera, etc., etc. And each of these villages occupies a hilltop and has, in general, a fort, a castle, and a church that you can see from great distances. Many of these villages were once, when Savoy was an independent entity, homes to small but extremely wealthy Jewish communities. Jews were involved in the textile trade, in buying and selling wines, in lots of mercantile activities in a way that was out of scale for the size of these villages. Until you realize, if you go to a restaurant in Barbaresco and ask for the wine list, you'll get one thick book that contains thousands of only Barbarescos and Barolos. Huh. And you get another thick book that contains wines from the rest of the world, including other regions of Italy, other parts of Europe, other continents, whatever. But it's like these two villages produce so much wine that there's a lot of money to be made in the wine trade. And in financing the equipment you need to transform the grapes into wines. In any case, Jews were invited in the 18th and 19th centuries by the rulers of Savoy. And they settled in many of these small villages, but there was one restriction. They couldn't build synagogues that were visible from the street as synagogues. So they tended to buy what Europeans call the first floor and we call the second floor of normal apartment buildings, knocked out the walls, and made a synagogue the size of a floor of the apartment building. Not huge, because the apartment buildings weren't huge. And the Jewish communities themselves had, in general, like 200 or 300 people at most. So they were never very big. Now all those Jewish communities are gone, except in Torino, where there's still a large, active synagogue and a big, well-functioning Jewish community. But in these villages, at the peak of their wealth, the Jews built incredibly beautiful, ornately decorated small synagogues, which are maintained by the Italian government. The problem is, my friends who were fluent in Italian and made Herculean efforts for weeks to arrange visits to at least one or two of these synagogues were unable to reach anybody at the phone numbers or the email addresses that had been posted.
Right.
So I don't know to what extent or under what circumstances these places are visitable. I'm sure if you went to the Italian Ministry of Tourism or Culture, you could arrange something. But we were unable to do that.
Tom, it's a fascinating issue and one we should talk about next week, which is what happens when the Jews leave an important area with synagogues and other institutions, and you know what happens to them. We will talk next week. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. And we have a Sukkot classic for you today. So a guy builds a sukkah on his fire escape in New York City. His landlord is so irate he sues him and insists that the judge force the tenant to remove the illegal structure. The judge agrees with the landlord and says, "I understand you have no permit for this unauthorized structure, sukkah." "That's true, Your Honor," says the guy, "but it's a religious requirement." "Well, that may very well be true, but the tabernacle structure must go," declares Judge Feldman. "I order you to remove it within 10 days. Next case." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish Just For You. You should live and be well. You see, he would have taken it down anyway. You only leave the sukkah up for a week. Never mind. And now a word of Torah. This coming Shabbat, we read the spectacular Torah portion of Bereishit, Genesis, the beginning of everything. It starts with those still amazing words, Bereishit bara Elohim, at the beginning of God's creating, or in the beginning, God created. Simple, lucid, concise, all creation emanating from one point and place, a divine force, intelligence, or energy, starting the great process of existence and eventually all life, a singularity. A poem to the holy unity of being. Everything comes from the same source. And yet, this text of Genesis is deliberately ambiguous. It encourages exploration and debate, the essential tools we human beings have for learning truth and discerning meaning. Questions abound. Why is God necessary at all for creation? There is room for argument, but that's good. Perhaps God-given, as well as incredibly Jewish. The notion that God created and then saw each thing is good, provoked from the great British author D.H. Lawrence, the poetic speculation that the true mystery of creation is the divine urge of creation. A great strange urge. God is a great urge, wonderful, mysterious, magnificent. God's urge takes shape in the flesh, and lo, it is creation. God looks on it himself in wonder for the first time. Oh, there is a creature formed. How strange. Let me think about it. Let me form an idea. We can argue, discuss, and explore whether such a marvel as the intricate workings of our world or our bodies, or even a single cell, could exist without some coherent plan or design. What a rich area for intellectual and spiritual engagement. Genesis is where real understanding and learning begin. This is where we start to shape our faith and our theology. This is how Torah commences, with the invitation to begin exploring a great and holy text in partnership with God, in community with the whole people of Israel. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest this morning, Suzette Schecht, the very youngest guest we have ever had in 20 years of broadcasting To Jewish, will join us again. She began writing her young adult memoir about her grandmother's Holocaust story when she was just 13 years old. It has now been published. She's all of 16. It's a well-written, engaging, and valuable book called Running for Shelter, A True Story. Is it a memoir or a novel? Find out from young Suzette when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel's government has approved a historic maritime accord with Lebanon. Both countries are under pressure to get the agreement signed before October ends, and their own leadership may change. The details of the deal have not yet been made fully public, but hours after his cabinet approved it, Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid said that Israel had declined two last-minute Lebanese demands to change the agreement. Lebanon had wanted to remove from the agreement Israel's freedom to secure a line of buoys installed by Israel as a functional border at sea in the Mediterranean. Lebanon did not want Israel to get income from a gas field the Lebanese planned to launch on their side of the border. But that's not how it turned out. The final deal preserves the buoy option and gives Israel dividends from any gas field that Lebanon develops, Lapid said. Israel will receive approximately 17% of the revenues from the Lebanese gas field, the Kana Sidon field, if and when they open it. Lebanese President Michel Aoun approved the deal. The final version of the offer satisfies Lebanon, meets its demands, and preserves its rights to its natural wealth. The deal is a first for Israel and Lebanon, a country still technically at war with Israel, which it has been since 1948. The agreement lacks the normalization component of Israel's agreements in 2020 with the four Arab countries under the Abraham Accords. It is not as comprehensive as the peace deals that Israel has signed with Egypt and Jordan and the PLO, but it marks a revolutionary sea change nonetheless in the relations between Israel and Lebanon, and this one was definitely negotiated by the Biden administration. Implementation is not guaranteed. Both governments are lame ducks. Aoun ends his term as president, and Lapid faces an election November 1st. Both sides plan to sign the agreement October 20th. Israel's hawkish opposition parties, led by Likud's Bibi Netanyahu, believe Lapid gave up too much territory at sea and have indicated they may launch legal challenges to the deal. Hezbollah, the terrorist militia, which retains a great deal of power and influence in Lebanon still, and which normally rejects any engagement with Israel, has not yet weighed in on the deal, but it has indicated it will support the agreement. I never thought I'd say these next words. It looks like the terrorists of Hezbollah are being more responsible here than Bibi Netanyahu. Criticism, predictably, has come from right-wing pro-Israel groups in the U.S. and from Republicans, led by Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who alleged that Lapid folded under Biden administration pressure. Lapid and his defense minister, Benny Gantz, deny they faced any pressure to sign the deal. They say that, if anything, this will tamp down tensions between Israel and Lebanon. Hezbollah previously had threatened to attack Israel if it launched a gas exploration platform in waters designated under Israeli control under this new agreement. Now that Lebanon has signed off on it, that is unlikely, Gantz said, in part because income from the gas fields could wean Lebanon's government off Hezbollah and its Iranian patrons. This important agreement serves Israel's interests and establishes a new security equation, said Gantz. Last week, when the deal had gotten a little shaky, he heightened Israel's alertness on the northern border. This has the potential to reduce Iran's influence on Lebanon, Benny Gantz added. Notably, AIPAC, the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the powerhouse lobby that's hawkish, but in most cases follows Israel's lead, praised the deal. AIPAC welcomes the U.S. brokered deal between Israel and Lebanon that demarcates Israel's maritime border and recognizes its economic rights to natural gas fields in the eastern Mediterranean, AIPAC said. We commend the Biden administration for working with the Israeli government to reach this historic agreement. Senior Biden administration officials ridiculed claims Israel gave away too much. They emphasized that Netanyahu, with many chances, hadn't made any agreement at all. Many people have said over the last several days a better deal could have been done, said the official. Others claim that they could have negotiated a better deal, some from the Middle East, some from the U.S. They were in power. They did not reach a better deal. And when those so-called better terms for either side were on the table, they ended up not reaching and not concluding an agreement. We did. An official investigation by Stanford University released last week confirmed long-standing suspicions that Stanford administrators acted to limit Jewish enrollment in the 1950s while publicly denying that they were doing exactly that. In tandem with the release of the report, Stanford's president, Mark Tessier Levine, apologized to the Jewish community on behalf of the university. This ugly component of Stanford's history, confirmed by this new report, is saddening and deeply troubling, Tessier Levine wrote. As a university, we must acknowledge it and confront it as a part of our history, as repellent as it is, and seek to do better. Tessier Levine wrote that Stanford will work to ensure that it is welcoming Jewish students today by increasing anti-bias training, creating a dedicated advisory committee, paying more attention to Jewish holiday cycles in university scheduling, and other measures. The university's first day of classes this fall took place on Rosh Hashanah. Well, Stanford has some work to do. Stanford convened this task force that produced the report last year after a historian published his discovery of documents left behind by Stanford's admission director from 1950 to 1970, Rixford Snyder, suggesting Snyder was biased against Jews and interested in reducing Jewish enrollment at Stanford. A similar conclusion was reached by the task force, consisting of faculty, staff, trustees, alumni, and students. For decades, it's been understood by many Jews in California that Stanford either had or has a bias against Jewish applicants, said Stanford history professor Ari Kelman, who chaired the task force. What we found was that the director of admissions, with knowledge of other members of high administration of the university, took steps to limit the number of Jewish students enrolled in Stanford. Evidence of Snyder's intentions is found in a 1953 memo written by his colleague Fred Glover and sent to then-Stanford president Wallace Sterling. Glover noted that Snyder felt too many of Stanford's male applicants were Jewish. The university must take action. Snyder feels that this problem is loaded with dynamite. He wanted you to know about it, as he says the situation forces him to disregard our stated policy of paying no attention to the race or religion of applicants, Glover wrote. According to the archival material, Snyder acted to accomplish his goal of reducing Jewish admissions by targeting Beverly Hills High School and Fairfax High School, two L.A. schools with predominantly Jewish student bodies in those days. If we accept a few Jewish applicants from these schools, the following year we get a flood of Jewish applicants, Glover wrote, relaying Snyder's concern. After the date of that memo, Snyder dropped Beverly Hills High and Fairfax from his recruitment efforts at Southern California schools. An analysis of enrollment data shows that Stanford soon saw a sharp drop in enrollment from those two high schools. Stanford's history of discrimination against Jews and other minorities is far from unique among elite American universities. At earlier points in the 20th century, Ivy League schools enacted far more blatant policies of discrimination, including official religious and racial quotas controlling the number of Jews enrolled. The fact that the anti-Semitism uncovered at Stanford was more subtle and came later is instructive as institutions across the country are increasingly reckoning with their past, said Stanford historian Emily Levine, who was part of the task force. In the 1950s, it was no longer so acceptable to be overtly anti-Semitic, Levine said. Anti-Semitism didn't so much go away as it went underground. About 7% of Stanford's undergraduates today are Jewish, according to data shared publicly by the university's Hillel. And finally, Ben Bernanke, the Jewish former chairman of the Federal Reserve, shared the Nobel Prize for Economics last week with two other scholars for their work examining how banks function in economic crises. Bernanke was recognized for an influential 1983 paper written when he was a professor at Stanford University that examined the Depression era to show how runs on banks during economic uncertainty tend to exacerbate and broaden a crisis. His theories helped inform his handling of the 2008 economic crisis and the bailout of major financial institutions at the time. Sharing the prize for their separate research into bank collapse were two American scholars, Douglas Diamond and Philip Dybvig. By the way, Douglas Diamond's father is Jewish, too. Bernanke, 68 years old, was chairman of the Fed from 2006 to 2014. He was one of at least five Jewish chairmen of the Federal Reserve, the U.S. central banking system. His predecessor, Alan Greenspan, was Jewish, as was his successor, Janet Yellen. Bernanke grew up in Dillon, South Carolina, and in his own autobiography wrote how he encountered anti-Semitism growing up. Classmates asked him if he had horns, but he saw that blacks had it much harder. His family was among the few Jewish families in town. They hosted rabbinical students who traveled from Hebrew Union College, New York City, to lead services for the congregation there. Mazel tov to Ben Bernanke on his Nobel Prize. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs. in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470 to speak to a family advisor at Evergreen. Call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Suzette Schiff, is the author of Running for Shelter, a true story Holocaust book for young adults. Suzette, we had to arrange this interview around your track schedule. You're now 16 years old. I'm going to ask you a funny question. You started writing this book when you were 13. I have worked with many bar and bat mitzvah kids on their speeches. I don't know that any of them were qualified to be put into a book. When you look back, not even my daughters, although that was pretty good, when you look back on your writing now, a couple of years later, do you feel, I could have done it better? Like, tell me about that experience.
So before I start, speaking of bar and bat mitzvah speeches, I actually, my Torah portion was around Passover, and so one of the Torah portions I was reading allowed me to talk a little bit about my grandmother's story and preserving family stories, which was really interesting because that was right before I started to write my book.
That's a great connection. Thank you.
So looking back on that, I think that I do still have all of the old drafts of my original writing. And so I definitely have seen improvement. When I look back at the original work, it was around 5 pages, single space, on Google Docs. It was written in the first person, while it's now written in the third person, and it was all very plain. And I think that over the course of rewriting, adding more, and editing, I've seen my work grow. But it's never perfect. I always will find, small changes I can make to my work, but at some point I have to just let it be, because I know that it will never be exactly perfect.
It's an interesting question. I mean, I've asked that of authors who've won, Pulitzer Prizes and Nobel Prizes, and obviously they weren't 16 years old looking back on their 13-year-old work. So, you're right. They say pretty much the same thing. After you create it, it's like your child, you got to let it go and then go on to other projects. What was the most difficult thing about writing the book?
It would probably be balancing my time with school and with writing the book. I think because I'm a teenager, I don't have all of the time that I would have liked to have to write the book, so it took a little bit longer to edit and to write certain sections than it would have if I was out of school. So I think that the scheduling was a little bit difficult to juggle. And I also think, I think that would probably be the main.
Did it affect your grades at all? That's the traditional Jewish question.
No, it did not.
I assume you're a good student.
Yes, I try.
Was there anything surprising that you discovered when you were doing research for the book?
I think that maybe the most surprising thing was just the more, I think it came when I was watching my grandmother's interview with the Shoah Foundation, because they asked certain questions that kind of forced her to reveal certain things. And so I think when I heard about some of the harder things that she went through that she hadn't originally shared with me, that I think that surprised me, because she's always put on such a very strong front, but in reality she's been through a lot.
You mentioned that you've developed, because of your own being, I guess this would make you a third generation survivor, right? Because we talk about second generation and third generation, that this has enhanced your interest in documenting the stories of people who have survived other genocides. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So I just finished, I'm not even really finished with this project because I still have, it's still not published yet, so not 100% finished with this project yet, but once I am, I hope to record the stories of other genocide survivors. So this next semester, I'm actually going to South Africa for the whole semester, and I'm studying there, And I am thinking about next summer also going to Rwanda to learn more about the Rwandan genocide and the events that happened there. And I think that the Rwandan genocide is one that I probably want to look at next, because I am taking an African history class in school this semester as well. And for my final project, I'm writing about the psychological effects that this had on the survivors. And so I'm going to be analyzing testimony, and I would love to actually be able to find and speak with living Rwanda genocide survivors too. So I think that one would be the next one.
How does your family feel about running for shelter?
My family is so proud of me. They've been incredibly supportive throughout this whole process. My mom and my brother and my grandma, they've all been looking out for me and helping me in any way I needed them. And so they're very proud of me, and I really appreciate all the support they've given me.
The Yiddish term is Shep Nachas. I'm sure they feel that way. It's an extraordinary book, and I'm just still a little blown away by the fact that you wrote most of this when you were 13 years old. Where can people go to find out more about you and to find out more about Running for Shelter?
Right now, you can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble to buy Running for Shelter, so you can learn a little bit more about me. And on November 9th, for anyone who lives in New York City, there's going to be a book signing in the at the Corner Bookstore from 5 to 6 p.m.
Suzette, I want to thank you and wish you great success with your book, Running for Shelter, which is this young adult Holocaust novel. Well, young adult Holocaust memoir. I'm not sure what to call it. What would you call it?
I think it's both a novel and a memoir, because it's written like a novel, but its essence is that of a memoir.
A true story Holocaust book from Suzette.
Yes, Shep. There we go.
Suzette, thank you so much for being here on Too Jewish.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this opportunity.
It's a great pleasure. And again, our youngest guest ever. So after 20 years and, I don't know, 1,050 guests or something, we'll hope to follow your career going forward as well. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Yair Rosenberg, creator and editor of the Deep Shtetl newsletter for The Atlantic Magazine, prominent journalist and musician. Don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha for Shmini Atzeret services with Yisker tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m. And in a very special celebration, the joyous experience of Simchat Torah tomorrow night with the dedication of our Torah, our brand new Torah, tomorrow night, 6:30 p.m. at Beit Simcha. Don't forget, join us also Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat, 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading in Kiddush in person, and also on our Facebook page. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for information and how to join our wonderful congregation. Play out this morning for Simchat Torah tomorrow night is a medley of Torah songs. My friends, have a Chag Sukkot Sameach, a happy completion of this holiday of Sukkot, a good Shmini Atzeret, and a joyous Simchat Torah. Moadim l'simcha, chagim uzmanim l'sason. Festivals of joy, a Shavua Tov, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace. Night.
בארץ עזרי מאים השם עושה שמיים בארץ סיסו את ירושלים גילו בה גילו בה כל אוהביה כל אוהביה סיסו את ירושלים
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.